Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review with Rob McKenna, former Attorney General for Washington State, Eric Liu, founder of Citizen University, Noelle Frame, Democrat representing the 36th District here in Washington State. We're going to review the news of the week. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Good to be here.
Thanks
Hi.
For coming in. Good to have you. Bernie or Hillary? Hillary or Bernie? Washington Democrats make that decision tomorrow at the precinct caucuses. And this week, KUOW went to the Sanders campaign office on Capitol Hill.
Bernie is a real candidate who's taking people on. He's not accepting corporate donations. He's not accepting money from the private prison industry, from the drug companies, you know, from Wall Street. And that says that he's about change. He's about changing the system. And that's something that I feel great about.
After serving in Iraq, my experience has turned me into something I don't want to be. And he's always been on the forefront of veterans' issues. And for example, it just took 4 years for the VA to recognize my PTSD. That's a problem. For 4 years, I've been struggling, you know, trying to find my way in the world since Iraq. And he's always been there for us.
We went to a Hillary Clinton phone bank in Seattle's Mount Baker neighborhood.
I'm one of those people, you know, you see on Facebook, they're holding up a sign that says, I borrowed $20,000 in student loans. I've paid back $33,000 and somehow I still owe $57,000. That is me, 100%. And I'm supposed to be saving for my kids' college right now. Hillary has a plan to refinance student loans, and that did not come out of Bernie's mouth first.
I've been a Hillary supporter since she was in the White House first time as first lady, mostly because she speaks up for women's rights and civil rights. And she's definitely got the know-how to do it. She's got the experience, and I think it's a no-brainer to me that she should be president.
Washington State Representative Noelle Frame, why should we vote for Sanders instead of Clinton?
Well, thank you for having me here. I think we should support Bernie Sanders because I think he is aspiring for a change that we need in America. A lot of what's happening in America today, it's not working for people. I am myself technically a millennial, and my generation has been economically decimated. We're the first in American history not to do better than our parents. That does not work, and we are desperate for a change, and we see that change happening in a Bernie Sanders presidency.
You use the word aspiring, and that seems to get at one of the arguments around Clinton versus Sanders, that is it enough to aspire to this change?
I think the presidency is a unique office with a bully pulpit and a bullhorn to inspire people to engage in their democracy. And the president is the leader, but we need people engaged in democracy at all levels. It is that grassroots movement that will truly be the change. And I see Bernie Sanders bringing people to the process.
Eric Liu, why should we vote for Hillary Clinton instead of Bernie Sanders?
Well,
if we're Democrats,
I think in the first place, I would say it is exciting to see not just the Sanders phenomenon, but to see the incredible support that he's getting around the country. I mean, you know, if you're a Democrat, whichever candidate you support, this is a great thing for the party and for the country to have tons of people, particularly young people, showing up and participating and getting involved and believing that change is possible, right? I mean, I think the absence of belief is what would scare me more than anything else. I think Bernie Sanders brings a lot to the table, and I think it's a reason why he's likely to prevail here in Washington this weekend. It's not just the things that we heard in the segment a moment ago. He brings a sense of imagination. He's pushing out the frame of the possible in politics, things that people in the establishment thought, oh, you can't do that, you can't go there. He's going there, mm-hmm. right? And that excites a lot of people. And that is, I think, you know, for the ecosystem, both of the Democratic Party and for the country, it's a good thing to expand that frame of the possible. The reason why I think, Hillary Clinton the reason why I will be supporting her, and let me just take pains to say, in my role as a citizen, not at all in my role running Citizen University, our organization, is really simple. I think Hillary Clinton, the job of presidency at the end of the day is about executing. It is about deciding. It is about making trade-offs. any executive role is not only about the bully pulpit or the megaphone. It is about, you know, making hard choices and choices in which all your options are shades of gray or shades of ugly. She is somebody who I think has the temperament and the experience to be able to do that well. She's a real in earnest. I mean, I've having worked in the White House, I spent a little bit of time in her company, never worked directly with her. And I have seen the ways in which she is a deep student, a deep learner, kind of voraciously curious and interested. And I just think, you know, somebody who has to do that job day in, day out to govern is she's got the right temperament and the right experience. But I think, you know, the job, the other part of the job that is about telling a bigger story, expanding people's sense of imagination, you know, Bernie Sanders is strong on that stuff, and you have to tip your hat to him.
Bernie Sanders' advocacy has worked for him. He's been in the Senate a long time. But what makes you think he doesn't have the ability to understand that, yes, being president is different from having my Senate seat and getting what he can? Why is that out of his grasp?
I don't think there's any, you know, let me say one thing to back up a step here. As a Hillary supporter, I think it would be bad for the party and for the country to have this turn into an intramural holy war. I think there are preferences to you know, people will make their judgments about which candidate is better. But I don't want the kind of food fight that we're seeing in the other party right now that is not only deeply personal attacks, but are you know, pushing people to a point where they couldn't possibly imagine imagine supporting another candidate, right? There are going to be people.
Are you seeing evidence of food fights? And we're just talking about experience versus.
No. In the Democratic Party, there are food fights.
They're not. Okay.
This is a good thing.
Yes. Okay.
The Republican Party is, right, you know, the most kind of charitable way to put it is food fight right
yes.
now. but I think among Democrats, look, Bernie Sanders is. I wrote a piece in which I basically contrasted the two of them. One is the gadfly, one is the grinder. And that's not a judgment on, you know, on the gadfly. A healthy ecosystem in politics needs both. You have to have somebody who's saying, this is wrong. This is not okay. What you all have been accepting, we got to break that, right? That is the role of the gadfly. The grinder has to be the one every day, as Noelle knows now, as she's a legislator, who is sitting through the hearings, who's getting incremental wins, who will take incremental wins, who can forge coalitions, even with people you don't particularly like, to get compromise, half-measure progress. That is Hillary Clinton's mode of operating more than it is Senator Sanders's. And it's, again, why I think she's more suited to govern. She may not be more effective at exciting an electorate, and she's not particularly as effective at communicating with kind of simple moral clarity and force her worldview. But when it comes down to actually having to do the day in, day out work of governing, you know, I put my money on her.
Let's bring in Rob McKenna, former state attorney general, Republican candidate for governor. What's your take on gadfly versus grinder Clinton Sanders?
Well, I think that Bernie is definitely more aspirational in the way he speaks and the way he delivers his message. And I think that's one of the reasons he attracts so much support from young people. It reminds me of the way that Ronald Reagan attracted widespread support from young voters when he ran for president in 1980. The largest percentage of the vote he received was from 18 to 24 year olds, because it was a message of hope. It was aspirational. It contrasted with Jimmy Carter pretty well, and I see that in Sanders. I think that Clinton is the classic policy wonk. I have a lot of respect for the fact that she thinks deeply about policy, what makes good policy. I think that as a president, what would give her the edge over Sanders is that she has been there and she understands what it takes to be successful as president. What that takes, in part, is the ability to work with the legislative branch successfully, which her husband did when he was president, which Reagan did when he was president. And you can cite a number of other examples as well from history. And you can cite examples of presidents who did not work effectively with Congress.
Who's that?
And that would include our current president, in my view, who has not shown a willingness to get down in the trenches, to build relationships the way that Reagan and Clinton did in recent times. And I cite them in particular because they faced Congresses controlled by the opposite party, whereas President Bush, the second President Bush, had a Congress controlled by his own party for much of the time he was there.
So you're endorsing Bernie Sanders for president?
Although I won't be voting for either of them, I don't know if I'll be voting at all for a candidate for president.
Oh, we'll be talking about that.
But
stay tuned.
But I do think that just looking at it as objectively as possible, that experience matters. And that Clinton's pragmatic approach, which is what I think her daughter Chelsea meant when she said her mom doesn't let the perfect be the enemy of the good, mm-hmm. that pragmatic approach works. And the more successful presidents adopt that approach. And as Reagan said, look, if you get 80% of what you want, you declare victory. And he let the other side say they got 80% of what they wanted, which is what he and Tip O'Neill used to do all the time. And it worked really well.
Okay, State Rep. Noelle Frame, I'll give you the final word on this little piece of the discussion since you're outnumbered. You, as Eric said, you're in the legislature, so you must have come to understand what it means to be a grinder and get things done with compromise. So your final chance to defend Sanders' ability to get things done, not just be, as Rob said, aspirational.
I think the grinder and the gadfly concept, they don't have to be mutually exclusive. And, you know, I've been in the legislature for 2.5 months. I've been a political organizer for 15 years. And what I would argue is, you know, you get the presidency, you do aspire, you bring people into the process, and you make sure that people understand that elections have consequences and democracy is at all levels. And if we want to advance a Sanders agenda, the revolution doesn't stop at the presidential level. And folks have to get involved and help to elect the people that reflect that platform at the congressional level and right here in the state. A lot of the issues that Bernie Sanders is talking about, they play out at the state and city level every day. And so if we want to deliver on the Sanders vision that he has aspired to do, we have to back it up with strong electoral outcomes that can help deliver that.
I want to ask a slightly different question now. Senator Sanders packed Key Arena over the weekend. He'll be back this evening trying to fill Safeco Field. Sanders has raised more donations and money from Washingtonians than Clinton has. Eric Liu, you predicted that Sanders is going to win in Washington State. Why do you think Washington is Bernie country? Because few, you know, most states haven't been so far in the Democratic column.
Well, I mean, there's the most basic thing is we are a state that, you know, we are the other Washington. We are not caught in Beltway conventional wisdom.
Why?
We do have a greater frame of both imagination in our politics here, but also a deeper strong streak. I mean, this goes back to the founding of the state that is anti-elite, anti-establishment, anti-people telling you, you know, what you ought to do and how you ought to be. And so someone like Sanders is very much, you know, in the wheelhouse of some of the deeper political traditions of the state. In the here and now, also, Sanders has done well, particularly in states that are that are better educated and that are more white. And Washington hits both those marks. And so this is a good state for him in that way.
Rob, you agree? Better educated, imaginative, anti-establishment, anti-elite. Does that sum up Washington Democrats?
Yeah, I think it does. If you look at history, I mean, this state went for Dukakis in 1988, if I recall. It went for Obama, of course, in 2008. There's a long history here of the folks who are center-left or left of center, you know, going more for the more liberal candidate. So it isn't all that surprising. It seems to be fairly consistent. And it's a trend which has been, I think, only reinforced by the influx of younger white tech worker voters. And so you're seeing that. I was struck during the news coverage from last fall's elections at Sawant, Councilmember Sawant's election night party. Everyone in the camera frame when they were showing everyone at the party looked like a young white guy who worked at Amazon or, you know, wrote code for video games. I mean, it was really striking. So I think this is consistent.
How do you think that imagination, anti-establishment, anti-elite attitude and education affects Washington Republicans? Is it two different worlds in Washington?
I think it's two different worlds. Remember, it's geography here, too, because a lot of Republican votes are east of the mountains. So we should definitely talk about that.
We are saying that Sanders is expected to win statewide.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you think it's Sanders in the West and Clinton in the East?
He'll win statewide. Will he win among Democratic voters in Spokane and Tri-Cities in Vancouver? I have no idea. I mean, will he win the state as a whole? Yes. I mean, that's pretty obvious from the polling and the donations and the activism. Yeah.
Do we just describe you, Sanders supporter, Noelle Frame?
Well, I will just quickly respond to what Rob just said. I do think we'll see Sanders support statewide. If there's any reflection, you know, there were 7,000 people packed into the Sun Dome in Yakima yesterday for Sanders. He had an overflow crowd in Vancouver on Sunday, a huge crowd in Spokane. I think that Washington, to what Eric said, we are a leader state. We absolutely believe in the politics of the possible. And so when we talk about aspiration, we do things here that are very aspirational. I don't think, as somebody who worked on the domestic partnership campaign in 2009, I can tell you we could barely imagine just a few years later that we would be legalizing marriage equality here in the state, and a couple of years after that, it would be the law of the land. We are absolutely imaginative and aspire here in Washington State, and we translate it into policy. And that's why I think you're seeing a Sanders support base here in the state of Washington.
Rob, you've talked about demographics, white and tech workers and educated. Do you think, how much do you think it's a matter of demographics that Washington is Sanders country among Democrats? And how much do you believe in this? We have a different personality. We have this, you know, this anti-elitism, anti-establishment. Is it more demographics, or is there something different about a Washington Democrat?
I think that attitudes and philosophies do tie to demographics. I think Eric put his finger on it when he said that Sanders does better in states that are wider, have higher average education levels. Maybe also, I haven't looked at how he does among, you know, high-tech workers in particular, but I'm guessing he does better. And he's doing better among younger voters than Hillary is, and that includes among younger women.
Yeah, see, you're talking everything you said is about demographics,
right?
And I'm just sort of curious: is there something else real about this? Something like a Washington State spirit, or is that overrated?
I think there is a Washington State spirit, but at the same time, this is a state in flux, right? We are changing, and the influx of young tech workers that Rob was alluding to is certainly changing King County and will eventually change the politics and the culture of the rest of the state. But the at its base still, I mean, this is deep, deep stuff when you think about a pioneer state like this.
It is.
People here are willing to cut against the grain of what the rest of the country or certainly the centers of power in the East Coast think our conventional wisdom or ought to be the way that you do things.
But having said that, just looking at the state as a whole politically, majority of the state Senate's Republican.
Right.
The House is nearly evenly split. You have 4 out of 10 members of Congress are Republican. The voters have repeatedly voted down a state income tax by large margins. They've repeatedly voted in spending limits again and again 6 times before the Supreme Court finally said, oh, you can't actually do that. So there are other indicators that say, looking at the state, not just Democratic voters, but looking at the state as a whole, that we're purple, right? That there's a mix.
Oh, yeah. When I say imaginative, I don't mean I appreciate that your assumption is that imaginative means Democrat or blue. but I don't necessarily mean that. I mean, I don't like Tim Iman. But the man has civic imagination. He went outside the box of how people people previously had been coming at tax issues, and he created a way that really limited the room for maneuver of the political establishment in Olympia. That is imagination, and he was very anti-establishment, anti the Olympia establishment. That tapped into the deep vein of the way that people are in the state as well.
Well, and I'll just add on to that, that the state and what we accomplish and how we accomplish it is really important to note that we do have a citizen process here to do ballot measures. And much of the progress that we have made, we're blue at the statewide level. We pass really progressive ballot measures. Structurally, we need a lot more of these great, Bernie-crats, as they like to call themselves, and other Democrats that are involved in the process to engage in the state elections. That's how a lot of this change happens. And Rob is right. I mean, Republicans control the state Senate, are only two seats away from taking the state House. And so there is some structural piece of this that we are a little anti-establishment in the state, and we tend to accomplish our most progressive work.
And maybe that's why tax cuts pass. I mean, you mentioned Iman. His first initiative was the car tabs tax, which the Olympia establishment on a bipartisan basis hated. But it passed. I'll never forget. I was on the county council. I was chairing the transportation committee. We saw some polling that indicated that a majority of Metro Transit drivers were planning to vote for the car tabs tax elimination. So maybe that's part of the anti-establishment attitude as well. Is when people vote for tax cuts and for spending limits, and they vote for a higher minimum wage, and they vote for a Public Records Act, and so forth.
Right across the board. Do most states have income taxes?
Yes,
all but 7.
So it's anti-establishment as well that we keep voting down an income tax, maybe. Anyway, let's pause. We need to pause because there's so much more to talk about, because there's a whole week to review. We haven't even talked about Republicans yet. We haven't said the word Trump. Stay tuned. With Noelle Frame, Eric Liu, and Rob McKenna, I'm Bill Radke, reviewing the week gone by and learning, we hope, in Republican news this week. Trump beat Cruz and Kasich in Arizona. Cruz beat Trump and Kasich in Utah, which means Trump leads in delegates, but he might not have enough to wrap up the nomination before the convention. Many Republicans have nightmares about a President Trump.
Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud.
Maybe I should say have a nightmares about even a nominee Trump, yeah.
Donald Trump is a phony, a fraud.
I'm very concerned for our country if we nominate him.
This is going to be a disaster for the Republican Party.
It's very dangerous for the country. Okay. I think it's very dangerous for the party.
Donald Trump as president, I believe, would be a disaster.
This party does not prey on people's prejudices.
Donald Trump does not represent me, and he does not represent my party.
Republican Rob McKenna, first of all, which Republican are you endorsing?
I haven't publicly endorsed a candidate at this point because every time I get close to endorsing one, they drop out. So I'm supporting.
You're endorsing Mitt Romney.
I'm supporting John Kasich,
okay.
Who has been a successful governor. And I think, frankly, we need someone with executive experience.
Here's my question. What is the future of the Republican Party?
Well, it's possible the Republican Party is undergoing a transformation at this point. The major political parties tend to do this every 30 years or so, very roughly speaking. We've seen it happen in the Democratic Party and the transition from a governor to Clinton, the McGovern era, to the Clinton more centrist era. It may be that this election represents the last gasp of Goldwater Reagan Republicanism as we've understood it. Trump is not clearing 50% in most places. He's not even hitting 40% in some places.
So you assume Trump loses to either
Clinton? Well, I'll get to that.
Okay.
But I my point is just that he's not a Republican in the view of many of us, number one. Number two, his philosophy is not coherent, and it's definitely not the small government, small taxes, consistent philosophy. I mean, he basically just says whatever comes into his mind at the moment or what he thinks people want to hear, and he's not tethered to any kind of principle or set of principles. That would certainly be the undoing of the Republican Party as we've known it, since it has been since the Goldwater Reagan era, anchored in a set of conservative principles that have been pretty consistent: small government, lower taxes, less regulation, etc. So that may be what we're observing. It's not clear yet. Now, on the question of whether he's going to be the nominee. He will not go into the convention with a majority of delegates. That's pretty clear. He would have to receive something like 58% of all the remaining delegates. That seems very unlikely given his performance to date. Therefore, he'll be short of the number of delegates he needs. What happens in that process is that after the first ballot, if no one achieves a majority, most of the delegates are freed up to vote for whoever they want, as opposed to coming out of a state that voted for Trump where they're obligated to vote for Trump on the first ballot. In most states, they're freed up. In some states, they're not, but in most states, they are. So there'll be a concerted effort to, first of all, block Trump from receiving a majority of delegate votes on the first ballot. On the second ballot, of course, the Cruz people will be working very hard trying to persuade Trump people who had to vote for Trump to come over to him. Some establishment Republicans have endorsed Cruz, although they don't really like him, people like Lindsey Graham and Jeb Bush, because they think he's the best alternative to Trump.
He's poison instead of a gunshot, as Lindsey Graham
said.
Yeah,
right. I love Lindsey. He's Senator Graham. But
if Trump loses, what makes you think, either the nomination or the presidency, what makes you think Trump is not a one-off? And Republicans, things go back to the way they were.
Yeah. Well, first of all, it's Trump himself. There just aren't very many people who are willing to be as outrageous as he is.
Right.
He's the first candidate in my lifetime that I can remember who has gone out of his way to not act presidential.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas normally we see candidates who try very, very hard to act presidential, and so in order to convince people they would be a good president.
So which is the future? Because you said transformation of the Republican Party. How do you decide whether the future is, well, look at Trump's success, it'll be repeated, party's cracking up, or, wow, Trump lost, if you think he's going to, and then so that was a one-off, and we get respectable again.
It's impossible to predict at this point. There are too many factors, too many variables, but what needs to happen for the party to be viable over the next couple of decades and beyond is that the approach taken by people like Marco Rubio or Nikki Haley or John Kasich or others, which is about expanding the party's base, has to be the approach the party takes. Otherwise, the party will just become a regional party at best and will not recapture the White House. It has to expand its base, which is what you always have to do in a two-party system.
Trump would say, actually, he has expanded the base.
Yeah, he would claim that.
He's brought in disaffected Democrats or people who long had been registered as Democrats but had drifted in part from the party. But I think, you know, the challenge here is deeper for the Republican Party than even Rob's serious statement, I think, conveys. This could be a shattering election for this party. And I think one of the reasons why is Trump is not a one-off. He is exceptionally kind of terrible and corrosive and repugnant as a candidate. What he has done is give voice to millions of voters who are not going away. And I'm not just talking about a hardcore of Trump's base who are, in fact, nativist, white nationalist, racist. There are some number who are just that, and they're unreconstructed. But there is another circle of Trump's base who have been left behind by this economy, who feel left behind by the changing demographics of this country that is not going to be white majority, in our lifetimes, and who don't feel like they have a place or a home or a voice in politics. They're still going to need a candidate. And the question that the Republican Party faces is, how much to focus on the aspirational, inclusive message of a guy like Paul Ryan now or Marco Rubio versus how much to do kind of the neo George Wallace, let's stir up, our old Confederate base here.
So there's all these scenarios for Republicans. I just want to speak on behalf of the listener who maybe is their biggest concern is what's this going to mean for America? You understand what I'm saying? Because maybe this just means Republicans will not win the presidency because they're splintered. And OK, that's fascinating for politicos. But for what's your feeling? What's your prediction for the country? Which way we head because of what's happened, what we've learned? And
I actually am, Trump's success? I'm an optimist. At Citizen University last weekend, we had our annual national conference, and we brought together people ranging from Tea Party right to Black Lives Matter left and all points between. And we are going through the painful, noisy, ugly period of the birthing of a new America. And it's hard. It's hard in our politics. It's hard in our culture. It's hard on people's sense of kind of psychic identity and place. But when we come out the other side, there's only one direction this country is going to move, I believe, and that is toward more inclusion and more, voice for more people. Now, if Trump wins or loses, the fact that the Republican Party is teetering isn't something that Democrats should just sit back and kind of smile and enjoy smugly because, Democratic Party itself has shakiness in its foundation. And I think our politics right now is going to shift in a different way, not so much around D versus R, but about people who are either comfortable with or are against concentrated bigness, concentrated clout, concentrated power. Sanders and Trump are in different ways speaking to the same phenomenon in this country, which is millions, tens of millions of people feel like they're not in charge of anything. They have no voice, they're not heard at all. Yeah. And that's still going to be our politics.
Yeah, I think that the country's been under a lot of economic. I'm sorry, Noel.
Go ahead, Rob. Finish your sentence.
It's probably going to be more sense. Like a paragraph.
I haven't heard from Noel yet on this subject.
Well, let me just
go ahead, but I do want to comment on that.
Okay. Well, let me just jump in and just, I want to be clear, and let's not give Trump too much credit. Trump is a narcissist, and he is not trying to advance an agenda or build a political party. He's launching a new reality TV show. I agree with Rob. He says whatever comes to his mind. I don't believe that he believes half of what he says, but it doesn't matter because he says it. And it's racist, and it's xenophobic, it's misogynist, and it is literally inciting violence in America. I don't want to give him too much credit. The Republican Party has let this go way too far. And I could, as a Democrat, sit smugly and say, yep, nominate Trump and we'll happily pick up the pieces afterwards. I hope the adults in the room, the statesmen in the Republican Party, will intervene and bring a more reasonable candidate to the table. I think it might be too late. They let this attitude, this ugliness, get so far down the path, it may be too late.
Well, I think you're giving them too much credit, they being the establishment Republicans, because they put up a lot of very qualified candidates at the outset, a number of governors and former governors. And the fact is, as Eric pointed out, there are people coming in and voting in our primaries who are not traditional Republican voters. So they're not Republican Party members, activists, et cetera. They are choosing to vote in the Republican primary. And in that sense, he has been expanding the base. But expanding the base assumes you're also holding what you have while you grow it. He's not. He's expanding it in some directions. But he's losing lots of other Republicans who can't stand him and will not vote for him if he is the nominee. As a consequence, I don't think he's going to have a lasting effect, notwithstanding your point, Bill, that that the party will have to think about what it means that all of these lower educated and other disaffected voters came in. On the left, we see a similar phenomenon that people who are disaffected with the establishment are voting for Sanders, not for Clinton. So they're economically stressed in many cases. On the right, there are people who are economically stressed who can't find work. Why? Because in part they have lower education levels and a lot of those jobs have disappeared. They're responding in very different ways, aren't they? Some of them are responding to Trump and his authoritarianism and his xenophobia, and some of them are responding to Sanders' message. And he's saying, no, we need more government, more stuff. But I think that what they have in common is they are stressed and they don't feel included. I think your point, Eric, about inclusion or alienation is extremely important here.
You know, the inverse for Democrats, let's imagine, you know, what still is probably most likely right now, which is that Clinton secures the nomination. The question then is, where do Sanders people go? Right. And I don't mean just, you know, how many of them are going to vote ultimately for Hillary in a general. I do think particularly if it's a Clinton-Trump election, most of these Sanders people will at the end of the day choose Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. But I mean, where do they go in a longer term sense? Right. You know, Noelle's point earlier about this isn't just about a president or a presidential candidate. This is about a citizen movement. Right. And whether you are on the right or the left, actually, this is a time right now where people have to start taking a new level of ownership and start exercising muscles, citizen muscles that have long gone atrophied. And that's going to have to be sustained past November 2016, and not just in national politics, in city politics, in state politics. And, you know, I think some of that energy on both the left and the right, if it can get converted into, hey, we're going to actually try to make things more inclusive, at least in the arena where we have some control in our town or in our county council or whatever, then some of this vibe of anti-establishment politics can live on in a healthy way.
And I wouldn't say I completely agree with that. And, you know, I had the privilege of speaking to Key Arena, the folks in Key Arena on Sunday. And my message to them, you know, was there are people fighting for you. And so if it does not turn out that Bernie Sanders is the nominee, I as an elected official, when a majority of my legislative colleagues were endorsing Clinton, I stuck my neck out because I wanted this incredible movement of people to know that there are people fighting for them. It may not be at the presidential level, you know, because I'm in the legislature, but there are people working on this and we hope they will stay engaged and to help advance that agenda. We need more engagement. I mean, this is so much of what the work that Eric does at all levels of government.
We're going to pause this part of the discussion. I just want to know, Rob, who will Washington State vote for in a Republican primary in May?
Yeah, it's probably going to, based on what I'm seeing in the grassroots at the caucuses, it's probably going to go for Cruz. Mm-hmm. I think it would have been likelier to go for Rubio if he'd stayed in. He was doing very well here, but it's sort of we're down to very few choices, and Kasich just hasn't had a presence here.
And then if it's Trump versus Clinton, do you vote? Do you endorse one or the other?
I don't, no.
You don't vote and you don't endorse?
Well, I'd probably do a write-in or something else,
okay.
But I can't vote for Trump.
But would you not endorse Hillary Clinton for president?
I would not endorse Hillary Clinton for president, no.
Because in effect, aren't you saying a non-endorsement means, one's as bad as the other.
Yeah.
Is that how you feel?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, as a Republican and as a Republican leader, I've picked, it's a team sport. We wear different colored jerseys.
Okay.
I picked mine.
All right. So I'm just going to pick out the note of optimism that I heard from Eric, who described the birthing of a new America. And you seem to look forward to that baby growing up. Although I will point out that childbirth is hard. So we'll see. We've got more to do as we review the week of the news here. We'll talk schools. We'll talk who's a craftsman person, who's a big box person, and maybe get to Man in Tree. Stay tuned.
You know,
Eric Liu's latest book is Chinaman's Chance, and he's the founder of Citizen University. Noelle Frame represents the 36th District, Seattle's 36th District in the legislature, a Democrat. Republican Rob McKenna was the attorney general here, ran for governor in this here state, and we're learning from the week's news with you. This week, the Seattle Times asked why public school students in Massachusetts test so much higher than Washington students. Their answers? Massachusetts spends about $15,000 per student compared to $10,000 in Washington. Massachusetts provides more early education. They hold schools more accountable. accountable, they train their teachers better, and their school day is longer. You have all read the articles. Eric, you served on Washington's Board of Education. First, do you agree that Massachusetts schools are superior to ours?
Well, I mean, the results that you're describing speak somewhat for themselves. I think the fact of the matter is, you know, that laundry list of items you just ran through of reasons why Massachusetts schools outperforms ours are kind of obvious for everybody to see. Money does matter. And when one state spends 40% more per pupil than another, you're going to get more results, particularly when that money is spent strategically, investing in early education, investing in teacher preparation the way that Massachusetts has. And, you know, so money matters. And our state, you know, Noel can tell you painfully from being, you know, in the legislature right now, a legislature that is still, you know, held in contempt by the state Supreme Court because it has failed to deliver upon its constitutional paramount duty to amply fund basic education. You know, so that's number one. But number two, you know, when I served on the State Board of Education, one thing that I learned with some wonder and then ultimately some frustration was just the crazy quilt governance system that we have in the state and the way that education works. I mean, it's not just the 290 plus school districts. It's the fact that you have a State Board of Ed that can make policy but can't enforce it. You have an elected superintendent of public instruction who has a bully pulpit but can't spend money directly. You have a legislature where every member of the legislature thinks they're the head of education and they've got an agenda. And it's really hard to get a concerted sense of strategy in the way that leaders in Massachusetts were able to do.
Representative Frame, is our bigger problem money or crazy quilt system?
It's money. I mean, our number one problem is that we don't put our money where our mouth is. We've done tremendous policy work over the years, but we have been out of compliance with our own state constitution for 30 years. This is what motivated me to run for office. I personally have been waiting 20 years for this solution. I was hit when I was a student in the Battleground School District. I was hit with this problem because the state was not meeting its basic funding obligation and our school had to pass levies in order to meet the basics. My school district couldn't pass a levy. We lost 3 levies in the 4 years I was in high school. And fast forward to today, what kills me as a representative, I am hearing the exact same problems that students are experiencing today that I experienced nearly 20 years ago. Lion Terry, who's the 2015 Teacher of the Year, teaches 4th grade at Lawton Elementary in Magnolia in my district. And he told me the story of just a student that was so excited about a book she was reading. She finished it in 2 days. She ran down to the library to get that next book in the series, but the doors were locked and the lights were off because Lawton Elementary can't afford a full-time librarian. 20 years ago, when we lost a levy, we got our librarian laid off. And I mean, I'm embarrassed for us as a state that we have not fixed this. Money's not all of it, but money's a big part of it. And we have committed now as a legislature that next session, 2017, in this new budget cycle, we are going to fully fund our schools per the McCleary mandate. But we have put together we've invested $3.5 billion more over the last 7 years. We have another $3.5 billion to do just next year, and it's tough.
Rob McKenna, is money the key to having schools as good as Massachusetts?
Money makes a difference, but it's not enough. As Massachusetts itself points out, you have to have a reform agenda. You then have to actually implement it. We have tended to start forward with reforms and not follow all the way through, in part because, as Eric points out, there's fragmented accountability, fragmented governance in this state, which is a real problem. So merely increasing the amount we spend wouldn't get us the results that Massachusetts has. I think, by the way, that one of the most important things they've done in a number of their schools is something I've seen here in Washington. We just don't do it nearly as much, and that is to extend the school day. And then to tie that, because what that allows you to do is you keep the kids in school longer, you're giving them more education, more instruction, more extracurricular, more enrichment. You give the teachers more money as a result as well. They make more money because they're teaching for a longer school day. I think that's
maybe worthwhile. Not per hour, but they're making more money because
right? because they're working until 5 o'clock yeah. instead of, you know,
8 hour instead of 6 hour day.
Yeah. Well, to be clear, teachers are working till five
yeah, they
o'clock
get there by seven.
Every day today.
But they're not working with the kids that many hours. That's my point. So, you know, a counterexample to the normal model in our state is Lincoln High School in Tacoma, where they have half the kids in a normal school day and half are there for an extra, I think it's 3 hours. They're getting remarkable results for those kids who are demographically identical to the other half. It's a perfect experiment if you want to think about it that way. When I was visiting the school, I asked the principal, since it was so successful, why wasn't every high school in Tacoma like Lincoln High School? And he said, because the other high schools don't have leaders and educators who want to step up and work the longer day and put the extra time in. They just don't want to do it. Even though they would make more money, they don't want to do it. Somehow we have to have the money to do it. I agree with Noel on that. But we also have to find the educators and leadership who are willing to, you know, adopt models that are different, more aggressive. I thought it was very telling in the article about Massachusetts that the head of the teachers union there criticized the quote hyper accountability close quote of their system. So you know, you always get pushback from the people who are in fact being held accountable, and that's been a problem in our state as well.
The Massachusetts teachers union leader said, "Our teachers are teaching to the test." She was skeptical about Massachusetts' success.
Well, I actually just want to go back to Lincoln High School really quick because I mentioned Lyon Terry in my district. The 2016 Teacher of the Year, Nathan Gibbs Bowling, is a teacher at Lincoln in Tacoma. And he came and visited us in the legislature. I had the privilege of sitting down with him one-on-one for some amount of time. And just reading his blog, which I would encourage everyone to read, Nathan talks about leadership and empowering the people that are doing a good job. But he also asks for more investment. And when you hear about the incredible work that Nathan and his colleagues are doing with their kids, brown and black kids, kids that are low income, he talks about this is life and death for them. They put in the hours, but boy, would they appreciate not having to be the teacher and the coach and the psychologist and the school nurse. You know, they are trying so hard and they really need support. And, you know, to Rob's point, yet we have some of these policies. We have tons of innovation across the state. It's not to scale because we don't put our money where our mouth is. We are not investing in these good policies across the state.
I think one of the things about, you know, you get into education politics and people get polarized and some people shout revenue and some people shout reform. And, you know, the point is you can't do reform without revenue. And I think reform also is itself a word that has gotten a bit polarized and turned into a hot button because to some people in the educational left, reform just means charter schools and vouchers and stuff that, you know, is threatening to a lot of the public school establishment. I think we need to have a bigger conversation about ed reform, because my view is it's not about charters or not charters or longer school day. You know, my view is our schools right now in this state are still set up on a model in which students are empty vessels and information is poured into them for X periods of day, and there is no creativity, there is no room for adaptation, and there's very little personalization of learning. And that's not because the teachers don't want to do it. There are teachers who want to go there, but they are stuck in a structure that is underfunded that doesn't enable them or empower them to do that. So I think, you know, we have to have a bigger conversation about what reform means and how, you know, if you take any excellent private school, and granted, they get to, in a sense, cherry pick their student body. But any excellent private school doesn't follow the same high stakes testing path that public schools have followed. It doesn't follow the sense that teachers are always under the gun and have this club of accountability being swung at them. These are schools where teachers are empowered to be creative, where they are funded, and where the you know where the students actually have the opportunity to learn in far more creative ways than you know. I'm a Seattle public school parent. My daughter, who's in high school, has never once been in a school where you had a full complement of teachers who could teach through the year with all the resources they needed. Never. It's just not happening.
Final word on schools to the Republican.
I hate to take time away from the man and tree, but there are 3 points I want to quickly make about funding. The first one is that we doubled the amount we spend per student in the state in constant dollars, inflation-adjusted dollars, since the 1970s. So we have dramatically increased spending. We have not seen not a doubling of results. In fact, we've seen very little progress in test scores, in graduation rates, et cetera. Some, but not nearly enough to you know match the amount of money. But number two, one of the reasons that we're under the McCleary mandate is that K-12 K-12 spending as a percentage of the state budget has been falling for 30 years. In the last couple of budgets, started to come up again. But as the State Board of Education and the Superintendent of Public Instruction will tell you, it has not kept up with the growth in state spending generally. If it had, we wouldn't be facing the McCleary mandate today, frankly.
Yeah.
You just do the math. We'd have the $3.5 billion if we just maintained K-12 share of the budget throughout that 30-year period. Number three, when you read the Seattle Times article, which I commend to all of the listeners if they haven't already read it, it's available online, of course. Take a look at the last screen, and there's a bar chart that shows where the money in Massachusetts comes from for education, for K-12, where it comes from in Washington. In Massachusetts, 51% of the money comes from local taxes. In Washington state, 27% comes from local taxes, that is levies, and it's unconstitutional. And it's, frankly, I think it should be. I think we should be funding basic education from the state because it creates inequality across the state, across school districts. But this is part of the challenge that Noelle and her colleagues face. We need to get back to where only, I'm going to say, roughly 10 or 11% of the cost of education comes from local taxes. That's a bigger burden on the state budget. But it does kind of paint an apples and oranges picture between Washington and Massachusetts that we have to remember.
Okay, we're going to continue on with the Week in Review in a moment. What does your home say about you? And where do the bad people live? Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. Thanks for tuning in. Seattle's growing and changing. The whole region is, and it's difficult. And this week, Ballard resident Kathy Hutchison, who lives in an old craftsman house, told us what it was like when a big box house went in nearby.
It's like, oh, you know, what kind of neighbors are we going to get? And they have more money, and so therefore, they're going to be different.
She tried to keep an open mind, but the big modern structures stuck out on this old street. She wondered if the potential buyers would stick out too.
We had to come up with something. We kind of called them the townies, because townhomes.
Townhomes, townies, the other people. Encroaching. We talked to a realtor in that story who told us why people sometimes go shopping for a craftsman because they think they're craftsman people and they find out they're actually big box people. And we met the woman who moved into that big box home who's now friends with the craftsman dweller. What does your home and your neighborhood say about who you are, about your identity? Anybody?
Well, I'll step up here. I'm definitely a craftsman gal and represent Ballard, so I totally appreciate that point of view.
You live in a craftsman?
I live in a bungalow is the best way that I would describe it. Mm-hmm. That said, I'm a first-time homeowner, just bought my house a couple years ago. And old houses are a lot of work.
Yeah.
And in that story, you know, when they mentioned if you're going to spend $200,000 on a remodel, I don't blame folks for wanting to go the big box route and wanting to start from scratch. It's why I buy relatively new cars. I don't know how to fix them, and I don't want the hassle of it.
Right. Maybe in the early 1900s, you had a small kitchen, and then you'd bring it all out to your guests in the dining room. But people are, if you didn't hear the story, people will go into a home and think, what I really want is that open floor plan. And so you're going to sink a bunch of money into that old house, making it into what you actually want, which might be a modern big box home.
You know, Bill, these kinds of debates, if you even want to call it that, between, you know, am I a craftsman person or a big box person? There are variations on this theme, right? I mean, it's the same debates that are unfolding in Noelle's district as well as in South Seattle about homeless encampments and about the, quote, character of a neighborhood changing. And, you know, we're in a period of this incredible economic flux in this city where a lot of people with a lot of wealth are coming in, where there are a lot of people falling through the cracks and falling through the floor of economic viability. And on both ends of that spectrum, you're seeing quite visibly the effects of the change. And so I think all of us, it's again, back to Noelle's point, it's not just about elected leaders. Every one of us who lives in this region, just as a citizen, has to be thinking kind of, how do we elevate the story? It's not a thing about craftsman versus big box. You know, what's a Seattle person? A Seattle person is somebody who, whichever kind of home you live in, whether you've been here for 4 months and work at Amazon or been here for 40 years and bought your bungalow for $10,000, you know, bucks in the 60s, you know, what are the values that hold us together here in Seattle, right? What are the ways of being, some of which we talked about politically, but also culturally, that make this the special kind of place it is, that makes it not New York, but also makes it not San Francisco, right? And I'd rather talk about those things than about my new house versus my old house. Or and you know, when we have that story, it's got to be about, look, you know, we welcome newcomers who bring vitality and smarts and economic prosperity to our community. But we have to look out for each other. And the fact that there are rising numbers of folks on the streets homeless, the fact that, at the low end of our economic spectrum, more people are hurting, means we've got to get real about who is us in Seattle.
Yeah, but I think it is. I think people do tie their identity to their abode to some extent, and it's been really fascinating. I've lived in Washington State since the mid '70s, moved here as a kid, and I've watched the changing architectural styles. You know, remember the Buckins? I'm talking about the Burbs now, right? Because that's mm-hmm. where I live, right? Mm-hmm. The Buckins and all the brick and the high arches and then that one. So what's popular right now? I live in a big box, because we wanted to move to a place with a view now that we're almost empty nesters and can do that. But our developer came up with the perfect solution. You get a big box with a Craftsman front. And it's the most popular model in our neighborhood.
Yeah.
So, I think...
So it's just a facade? You have
Yeah,
the stones, so, the pillars, the eaves, all that stuff
exactly.
has nothing to do with what's inside them.
Well, the floor, so you can get this one floor plan that we have. You can get three different fronts for it. You can get the modern front, it's very modern, a lot of horizontal lines, sort of Frank Lloyd Wright type. Uh-huh. You can get the Craftsman front, or you can get the kind of Cape Cod shingle front, depending on what you want. But when you walk in, you don't have the reaction the person in Ballard does with the Craftsman when they walk in and say, this is kind of small. Where's my media center?
Yeah.
Where's my exercise room? So you get all that stuff, but you get the Craftsman front, which I think is pretty funny, actually.
Yeah, I can't deny that I love part of the Craftsman feel. But I will say, Bill, I'm so happy that you said that the townhome and the bungalow or the Craftsman person came back together, because I think it's what Eric said.
Can't we all just get along?
Seriously. Really? It's so much of it's about community. And, I like my house, but I love my neighbors. And they make it why I want to be there. And so much of this is, we're human beings, so I'm so glad to hear that they talked, because that helps us overcome so much of our differences.
Just a final note, though, when I said we got to get real, I don't mean only can't we get along. I mean, we got to own the fact that some people are prospering and some people are not. And if we want everybody to be included, some people have to give up a little bit. And that's going to be in taxes. That's going to be in some inconvenience. That's going to be in maybe having a homeless encampment not far from you that's temporary. This is what it means to live together. And I think that's part of getting real as much as...
There goes Dr. Liu again, making sure we eat our oatmeal and our broccoli.
One final note, speaking of oatmeal versus broccoli versus apples. This week, Seattle and the internet were transfixed by a man who climbed at the top of an 80-foot tree outside Macy's downtown. Fire department tried to rescue him. He threw branches at them, threw apples at onlookers, spent the night in the tree, stopped traffic. And all of Seattle in the internet, apparently everyone wanted to talk about it except the three people in this room. And they've managed to talk about schools, school funding and politics and the birth of a new America for an hour, and just leaving the man in the tree to his thoughts. So congratulations. This has been the Week in Review, and we've been talking with Eric Liu, founder of Citizen University, author most recently of Chinaman's Chance, Rob McKenna, former Attorney General for Washington State, Noel Frame, Democrat representing the 36th District in Seattle, and I'm so glad you've joined us. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
On Facebook, KUOW Public Radio, live tweeting at KUOW. You never really have to miss the show. Get a podcast of the show at KUOW.org or your favorite podcast app. Thanks, Bernard Ouellette, Amina Alsadi. Thanks for tuning in.